Hello, welcome to All in the Mind. Lynn Malcolm with you. And it's great to be back for 2015. And what better way to start than to celebrate the brain's amazing ability to change and heal itself in response to mental experience?
Because we know the brain is plastic, we have a first-level roadmap for understanding what we need to do to drive it back in an improving direction. And in many neurological conditions, many psychiatric conditions, we've been quite successful.
It is changing it at a physiological level, and what I see is all of the symptoms drop away, like everything related to that cognitive deficit as it's improved through the exercise shifts.
We're almost always worried about training the machinery of the brain that's controlling learning itself, because that's plastic. We want to make you a powerful and effective learner again so you can acquire and get all the benefits of your brain plasticity.
Professor of Neuroscience Michael Merzenich and psychologist and educator Barbara Arrowsmith-Young. They're from previous All in the Mind episodes. The discovery of neuroplasticity is thought to be one of the most important developments in our understanding of the brain. It's no longer considered to be fixed and unchangeable. It can create new neural pathways to adapt to its needs. This has led to an explosion of interest in the power of brain training to improve its performance. And now, a new therapeutic potential is being explored. Today, we hear some astonishing stories demonstrating that the brain has its own unique way of healing.
So many Western neuroscientists and clinicians have benefited and learned from things like yoga, meditation, visualization, and things that have been practiced in the East for a long time. I think neuroplasticity is a subject that can bring together these two great medical traditions of humanity. The energy I talk about, it's not flaky. You can analyze it in terms of Western scientific equations.
Dr. Norman Doidge is a psychiatrist and researcher from the University of Toronto in Canada and author of the bestseller from 2007, The Brain That Changes Itself, which really put the concept of neuroplasticity in the spotlight. His latest book, The Brain's Way of Healing, is a result of his world travels meeting doctors and patients who are benefiting from neuroplasticity, healing the brain without medication or surgery. He explains what can go wrong in the brain and how neuroplastic healing works.
The first thing that I think it's best to attend to is the general neuronal and cellular health, and that goes awry in certain conditions. It goes awry to some degree in autism and in MS. It's probably going awry to some degree in Parkinson's. It's probably going awry in many children with ADD. Then the next thing that happens is the cellular problems that are based on too much inflammation or toxins or maybe some genetically induced cellular abnormalities give rise to wiring problems. And when the brain has wiring difficulties, the circuits don't work and they go dormant. And it's not just the case that the brain cells are dead or that they're not firing at all. Often the problem is that they're firing, but at irregular rates or at the wrong rate. And when that is happening, they can't perform their function and they go dormant. But I call that the noisy brain. And so they need some kind of stimulation to pull them out of that dormancy. And if the stimulation works properly, then the brain gets modulated. I call that neuromodulation. And lots of systems that weren't working well suddenly start to work together, and there's a balance of excitation and inhibition. I mean, an example might be, think of people with traumatic brain injury. There's certain things they can't do anymore. That's because circuits are dormant, but there's other circuits that seem to be hyperactive. So they're very, very sensitive to sounds and light and so on. That all has to be rebalanced. And then the brain goes through a period of rest, and then it goes through learning.
In his travels, Norman Doidge met John Pepper, who'd been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's is a result of damage to the dopamine-producing cells in the brain, which help us make automatic movements. This leads to difficulties with movement, balance, and walking. John Pepper was prescribed standard Parkinson's medication, but his condition didn't improve. Around this time, he decided to join his wife in a gentle Get Fit program, which focused on walking.
And while he was there, one of the instructors, you know, said, "Pepper, you're not walking straight." And she started to get him to pay attention to his gait. And I think that this was not intentional on his part, but he started to break his walking down into individual movements. Now, that's really interesting because take something like brushing your teeth or, I don't know, putting on a shirt. These are things that we have to learn how to do, and we've forgotten that we had to learn how to do them by doing individual movements. But once they become automatic, the part of the brain, the substantia nigra and the basal ganglia that are involved in making the things automatic, take over weaving those individual movements together. While he was paying really close attention to his gait, you know, it would be something like shift your weight to your left leg, raise your right leg at your hip, swing the foot forward from the knee, go into a controlled fall forward onto your right heel, and so on. He broke it down like that. And what he found was that he could do movements with that level of awareness by breaking it down, because that's not broken in the Parkinson's brain, if you will. So he was actually using another part of his brain in the frontal lobes to kind of work around the Parkinson's. And he was just such an earnest, conscientious person that he got to the point where he was walking quite briskly with this technique. And he called it the conscious walking technique, and he applied it to other movements as well. Some of his Parkinson's symptoms were starting to improve. He just wasn't quite as rigid as he used to be. And so he did some research. And there was an extensive research that was just coming out that showed that walking actually triggers brain growth factors of two kinds. One that consolidates connections between the neurons, and another one that supports what are called the glial cells. And the glial cells were originally thought to be the infrastructure of the brain that support the neurons, but we now know that they're also communicative. And so he tapped into this literature, and he was able to teach other people to do this. Here was a man with advanced, you know, had had Parkinson's for years, and he still has Parkinson's, but he learned how to diminish the symptoms by triggering growth factors with this workaround. What we realized was that, you know, the person with Parkinson's is caught in a noose. They increasingly can't move, and yet one of the things that would actually help their brain deal with the Parkinson's would be walking, because walking triggers these growth factors. So what was he doing in terms of what I was talking about? He was actually using activity, thought, and movement to stimulate the dormant circuitry in the brain. So this was a neurostimulation intervention, but I think it was also because it was stimulating the glial cells, which again provide infrastructure and support for the neurons, which are the nerve cells that carry electrical and chemical signals in the brain. It was also to some degree addressing normal cellular and neuronal health. So it's the first two stages. And of course, the thing that's so beautiful about this is it's something that anyone has access to. And the interesting thing is that, you know, people with Parkinson's are very prone to certain kinds of setbacks. They can, you know, they have trouble swallowing. They're prone to get pneumonia and things like that. And sometimes he was laid up once for an operation, once because he got pneumonia and he couldn't walk. And what happened was he regressed, so that his movement symptoms returned much more intensely when he couldn't walk. And it would take him about 6 weeks of learning how to walk just to hear as he originally had, and then building up to his hour and 15-minute walking every other day for him to get control of the movement symptoms again.
So a couple of things struck me about that story. One is that you were talking about close attention. He was paying very close attention to walking, and that's an aspect of mindfulness that we hear about, that attention is very important. And the other thing is that the brain found a way around a shortfall. So it found another part of the brain to get around the problem. Also, I guess it draws attention to the very simple act of walking and how valuable a movement in the body can be for the brain.
Absolutely. And, you know, just over a year ago, there was a study, the biggest study ever done of exercise and dementia risk. And it was done in Wales by the Cochrane Institute. This is part of a study that was designed by Archibald Cochrane, who was said to be the father of evidence-based medicine. And they followed over 2,200 men for 30 years in Wales. And they did five healthy behaviors: exercise, not smoking, not drinking more than a glass of wine a day, eating about four servings of fruits and vegetables a day, and being a normal weight. And they found if the men did four of those five activities, they reduced the risk of developing dementia by a staggering 60%. Now, if any drug did that, it'd be the most talked about drug in the world, probably.
Yeah.
And the most powerful factor was exercise. And exercise wasn't brutal cross-fitness. It was the men walking a mile to work and a mile home 5 days a week. So that's about half an hour a day, I think. Or riding their bike 10 miles a day, 5 days a week, or regular vigorous exercise. And I think it goes back to what I said. We have had a very disembodied view of the brain. I call it the imperial brain. There's been a tendency to think about the brain as separate from the body for all sorts of reasons, and to think that if a person has a brain problem, the only way to fix it is cracking open the skull and getting into the brain, or giving a person a medication to get into the brain. But all the interventions I describe in this book for Parkinson's, MS, traumatic brain injury, chronic pain, attention deficit, autism, learning disorders, dyslexia, sensory processing disorders, they're all non-invasive. And they all use the senses or movement of the body to access the brain.
I wonder if we could move now to pain. It's a human experience which we've always accepted has a strong mind component. What have you learnt about the nature of pain and therefore how it can be better managed?
Well, I've learned several things with respect to pain and neuroplasticity. There's two kinds of pain. There's acute pain, and acute pain is basically a warning not to move a body part because you could cause further damage to it. So we need our acute pain. But sometimes it's not only the body part that's injured when we hurt ourselves. Sometimes over time we also injure the body part and the pain system itself. And this typically happens because the pain system is being chronically stimulated over time. Now, the brain is neuroplastic and the nervous system is neuroplastic, which means that it changes its structure and function in response to activity and mental experience. That's what it does. It's a blessing when you are trying to learn how to paint or enjoy music and you go to the opera and you find, as you get better at it, you can hear many voices in the choir and distinguish those voices. You can develop differentiation of your sound maps in that case. It's a curse when the sense that's being stimulated over time and getting better is the pain sense. Then what happens is even a small movement of the injured body part can lead to a jolt of pain that lasts very, very long and spreads out over the body. I mean, I can tell this best by telling the story I tell in this book of Michael Moskowitz, who was a pain physician and a psychiatrist, and he'd had several experiences that taught him important lessons. The first one was on the 4th of July many years ago. He went with a friend just outside the San Rafael dump where they were storing some tanks for the 4th of July parade, military tanks. And he climbed up on one and he jumped off. And as he was going down, his corduroys were caught on a piece of metal. And he heard three pops, and that was the sound of the longest bone in the body, the femur, cracking in three spots. And as he lay there on the ground, he was actually bleeding to death. And he was experiencing what pain physicians call a 10 out of 10 pain, and realizing that he could tolerate it. He also noticed as he was waiting for the ambulance that if he didn't move at all for an entire minute, the pain stopped completely. And he thought to himself, you know, I'd been teaching my medical residents about this for a long time, that there are these switches or gates in the brain. That was the main theory of pain. But now I've lived it. I realize it's really real. The brain can turn off pain. My God, there's a switch in there. And that was an important lesson for him. And he had another lesson, and that is he was doing a kind of water skiing with his daughters. He was on an inflatable tube going at a high speed. He flipped over and injured his neck And originally there was just one part of his neck that was hurting. But as time passed, that nerve kept getting pressed on, that neuroplastic system started to grow, and it became a chronic pain. So that instead of having pain in one point of his neck, it was now spread out over all of his neck, his shoulders, his head, and it was disabling. And at that point, neuroplasticity was starting to be a word that was being used. And he read 15,000 pages of the scientific literature on plasticity. Now, he was a pain physician who came at it from psychiatry, was also a psychiatrist. So he was very attuned to the mind-body connection. And as a pain physician, he knew that there's not just one pain center in the brain, but there's about a dozen centers in the brain that process pain. And interestingly, almost all of them don't just process pain. They process something else. So you may have noticed when you're in pain, you get cranky. And that's because there's an area of the brain that processes pain and emotional regulation. Or that you can't do higher math and you can't visualize certain things. And believe it or not, there are two areas of the brain that process both visual imagery and pain. Oh, he also knew one other thing. When the brain's not in pain, that map for imagery and pain isn't really firing. When it's an acute pain, there's a certain amount of firing that you can see on an fMRI. And when it's in chronic pain, about 15% of that map that would normally be used to process imagery gets hijacked to process more pain. So he had the following thought: every time I'm in pain, I will force myself to have visual imagery to try to take back that combined pain imagery map for imagery. Because he knew from studies, and he'd also read my first book, that plasticity is competitive. And so it's a use it or lose it brain. When you use a brain processing area for a particular activity, the part of that processing area that's devoted for that activity actually expands. And when you use it for something else, that other activity kind of invades it and takes it over. So we would use the competitive nature of plasticity. Now, for the first couple of weeks, every moment he detected any pain, he visualized, and he got no results. But after several weeks, he started to get some results. And by several months, you know, he could go 15, 20 minutes or whatever without pain. And at the end of the year, he had no pain. And I want to emphasize that when he started doing this, he had been tried on all the known pain medications, nerve blocks, you know, things that we use in mainstream medicine. And he had tried all the complementary and alternative things. And at the end of the year, he was off all pain meds. And he was basically pain-free. So he beat back his chronic pain with this neuroplastic mental intervention, if you will.
Norman Doidge, author of The Brain's Way of Healing. You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia, and perhaps on your ABC mobile app. I'm Lynne Malcolm, today with some remarkable stories of recovery from pain and brain injury through neuroplastic healing. It sounds almost miraculous. What can people that are listening to this who may be dealing with pain draw from it? Do people have to actually believe in the power of neuroplasticity, for example, for it to work?
No. This isn't a belief-based thing. It's not a placebo thing either. You know, placebo, which is a very, very interesting and important thing to understand, is when people are expecting a good response to something, a medication, and then something about the mind switches on part of the brain so that they get that response. And there are placebo responses in pain and depression. Placebo responses vary by illness. But in general, what happens with the placebo response is over time, it wanes. And of course, you always have to be doing the technique. The opposite pattern was seen with Moskowitz. Over time, the pain relief got stronger, and he had to use the technique less and less. So he was training up new circuitry. So you don't have to believe this. You just have to be willing to do it. And the other thing I want to emphasize about plasticity and pain is that, you know, many, many people get hooked on our medications for pain, and that's also a plasticity story. Our body produces, the term is endogenous, but it just means its own pain-relieving substances, you know, these are the endorphins and so on that we produce that can block out our pain. But when people have profound pain problems, we supplement these endogenous endorphins with chemicals that are very much like them. But over time, people need more and more of these drugs because they develop tolerance to them. And that's because the brain is neuroplastic. And so if you start loading the receptors for the neurons up with these drugs, it's not as though the brain stays still. The brain always responds to activity. And it says, boy, there's just too much of this, whatever the drug is, you know, this narcotic or whatever it is around. So I'm going to become less sensitive to it. Therefore, the person's not only going to need more of the exogenous medication to get the same bang for their buck, but because their own receptors are becoming less sensitive to these drugs, they're even less sensitive to their own endogenous pain, endorphins, and so on. So many, many people with chronic pain syndromes, they start off with these medications. In the acute situation, they work beautifully to eliminate pain. But if they're used chronically over time, you need more and more of them, and then they have some pretty bad side effects. But what's great about the Moskowitz approach and the neuroplastic approach is you can, in many cases, eliminate the pain altogether. And in some cases, you can't go that far, but you can lower the amount of medication the person needs. So they get far fewer side effects.
You've also written about neuroplastic interventions that work for children with autism. And the key to that lies in the connection between music and the brain. Can you describe an example of what you've seen in that area?
Sure. When we study people who are listening to music, we find that their neurons are firing at the dominant frequency of the music that they're listening to. And not only that, you take two jazz musicians, put them in a room, and hook them up to an EEG, an electroencephalogram, and their brain waves start to synchronize. This is called entrainment. That's very cool. They say they're in the groove. They're capturing something that's going on in the brain. Okay, now autism. You may have noticed that many autistic children are often covering their ears and showing great signs of distress. What it turns out is going on in their brains is the following. A person who doesn't have this autism will walk into a noisy room. Think of a party. At first, you just hear booming, buzzing confusion. And then very quickly, your perceptual experience is transformed and you can start to make out conversations. You know, one's about politics and one's about religion and one's about sports. Now, the frequencies of human speech are actually fairly high in the spectrum of the things that we can hear. We can hone in on that because in the ear-brain circuit for listening, there is what a person I describe in the book, Alfred Tomatisa, he was an MD, an ENT doctor, described as the auditory zoom. Just as a camera has a zoom that allows you to focus in on certain things, a healthy ear brain circuit has an auditory zoom, and that is not working in autistic kids. And so it seems that they are hearing lower frequencies. Now, lower frequencies, for evolutionary reasons, tend to be very threatening to human beings. In general, the sounds made by our predators turn on our survival fight-flight reaction and get us very, very tense. So, for instance, if I suddenly started talking like this, you would think that an alien had come into Norman Doidge's body and brain. Or if you go and see the movie Jaws and the shark comes on, filmmakers always have low, predatory, rumbling sounds going on, you know, when the monster arrives on the scene. Well, the autistic kids are hearing this all the time. So in the techniques I describe in the book, the brain is neuroplastically trained with modified music, or in autistic kids, we use the mother's voice modified. And we very, very gently introduce the frequencies of human speech, but very, very slowly, just the frequencies in the modified music, and then go back to what they're accustomed to hearing, and slowly and incrementally train up that auditory zoom. And in the book, I describe the case of Timothy, who at 18 months underwent an autistic regression. His language just got fixated. He just said, do, 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 do. He lost eye contact with his parents. He had constant temper tantrums. and many typical signs of autism, and his parents felt that he was no longer relating to them as people. He went to this place in Toronto called the Listening Center that used these techniques. After the second day on the way home, his grandmother said, "There's something different about Timothy." On the third day, he spontaneously hugged his father for the first time in his life. And, you know, Timothy was supposed to be institutionalized. That's what his parents were told would happen to him. And he had moderate severe autism. And today it's almost the end of the school year. He got A's in English. He's had some friends. But most importantly, his parents said, you know, we got our relationship back with him. Here's a boy that was on track to be in an institution, and he'll probably be living independently. I describe another boy, Jordan Rosen. That's his real name. Jordan Rosen, too, was supposed to be institutionalized, having temper tantrums, biting people all the time. And today, if you met him, you simply would not be able to tell that he was once autistic. And he is socially attuned. He's got a job, lots of friends, graduated from university. I'm not saying that usually happens with this treatment. The more common result is the Timothy result, where he went from moderate severe autism to mild. But this helped him to rewire his brain in a very positive direction.
I wonder what you see in the future regarding this concept of neuroplasticity. In the best of all possible worlds, what changes would you like to see in the medical world in its approaches to healing, bearing neuroplasticity in mind?
Well, I'd like to see some of these treatments more widely distributed so that neurologists, for instance, start recommending activity very early on for a number of these diseases, and particularly neurologists becoming aware of them so people don't have to find them by themselves. A lot of it's an attitudinal change. You know, because people believed that the brain was fixed, it gave rise to this neurological nihilism where people kind of reflexly just sort of talk about a number of conditions as though nothing can be done. And it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you believe nothing can be done, then when you hear about these kinds of conditions, you immediately assume that it's false hope. I really wish people would look into these things before they declared that just because they don't fit with the existing paradigm, that they're not possible. I think the scientific attitude is a systematic, mature skepticism, which is skeptical of itself as well. And so if it encounters something that it hasn't met before, the idea is not to roll your eyes away from it and not look at it, but to actually look at it more intensively. So we need more studies of these things as well.
Norman Doidge, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much.
And details of Norman Doidge's books, including The Brain's Way of Healing, are on our webpage. And next month, Norman Doidge will be appearing at the Sydney Writers' Festival. While you're on our webpage, leave a comment about this topic. We'd love to hear from you. And you can sign up to the All in the Mind podcast there too at abc.net.au/rn and choose All in the Mind in the list. Thanks to producer Diane Dean and sound engineer Mark Don. I'm Lynne Malcolm, bringing you All in the Mind each week this year, same time, same station. Bye for now.